Hey everybody, welcome back to another episode of Ask Katie Anything. I'm your host, licensed marriage and family therapist, Katie Morton. I'm so glad that you're here. In today's episode, I'm going to discuss the difference between trauma from a single event versus multiple events, essentially PTSD versus complex PTSD. What's the difference? How do we treat them? I'm also going to explain why a therapist might ask if you want to schedule your next appointment each and every time that they see you, and how to stop ruminating. There was a big question about rumination and how do we get ourselves out of it? Why self-harm can often be linked to a lack of validation. And finally, I'm going to discuss boundaries, why they can be hard to set and uphold, and also why they can feel bad sometimes. Without further ado, let's jump right into, with further ado, if you're looking to connect with our community in more ways, I want you to know that we do have YouTube memberships as well as Patreon available. Both of those options allow you to engage with the community on Patreon. We have a Discord server where you can chat with other people. In YouTube, we have the community tab where I post and people communicate back and forth just like you do in the questions here. You can also ask your questions to get them answered in Patreon and in the YouTube memberships. There's a ton of ways to get involved if you're looking for more support. And also if you want to purchase any workshops, I have them available at katiemorton.com if you're looking to kickstart your mental health journey. Okay, now let's get into those questions. Question number one says, hey Katie, how does trauma due to a single event, for example, a car accident or a rape, differ from trauma from an extended period of time and multiple associated incidences? For example, a soldier in heavy combat during a deployment or being in an abusive relationship for years. How do symptoms and the overall impact differ? How does the approach that a therapist takes to treat these two different scenarios differ? Is one easier to recover from than the other? Thanks. And someone also added a comment and said, yes. And why does a fatal car accident in the present bring up old traumas from years past? Okay, first of all, I want you to understand the difference between PTSD and complex PTSD. And for those of you who don't know, post-traumatic stress disorder is, we don't have a new diagnosis in the DSM for complex PTSD, but it is very different. But post-traumatic stress disorder or PTSD happens when we are traumatized, meaning what happens to us in our life is more than we can manage in the moment. It means that we fear for our life or safety or the life and safety of someone else. And we can be traumatized and not develop PTSD, meaning that I can be in a traumatizing situation. I can have something happen to me that is so overwhelming, so terrifying that I'm traumatized, yet I have a level of resilience and support in my life that I'm able to manage it, overcome it, and move forward. But some of us aren't able to, right? We don't always have all the tools and skills, especially if we were young. And so we can develop PTSD. Now, I just want to say that so we're all understanding. The difference, though, between PTSD and complex PTSD is really the extra layers in complex PTSD, meaning PTSD itself, you know, we avoid things that remind us of the past trauma. You know, we feel threatened a lot. We can be hypervigilant. And we can have flashbacks and things like that. Now, complex PTSD has all of that, but there's also this added component of like a negative self-concept, thinking something's wrong with us, we must be broken. The shame can be much stronger when we have repeated traumas. We can also really struggle to regulate our emotions. We can feel dysregulated quickly. We can fly off the handle really fast with people that we love. And we can really, really struggle in our relationships. I would argue that there might even be more overlap between complex PTSD and borderline personality disorder than there is between complex PTSD and PTSD. Now, that's just, I'd have to, you know, run my numbers, do my research, but that's just off the top of my head. I really feel like there's a lot of overlap because of those additional components, you know, things like chronic and extensive stress, emotion regulation, interpersonal difficulties, like all of those things come out, are also in borderline personality disorder as well. Okay, with all that being said, now, does trauma due to a single event differ? The trauma itself doesn't differ. I mean, it just depends on what's happening to us, but the way that we interpret it does. And that means that when we have repeated traumas, we start to think that it's something that we've done. We can struggle with like our own beliefs about ourselves. We can struggle in our relationships more. And so yes, the symptoms differ a little bit and the overall impact will differ because especially for complex PTSD, when something goes on for a long period in our life, let's say we're traumatized for years, that means that we can struggle with memory of that time. It means we can have there's a ton of different situations and feelings and experiences that we can have flashbacks about or trauma memories in our body, nightmares, night terrors, things like that. And the approach the therapist would use would be similar in many aspects. But again, there's going to be this component that I would argue would be dialectical behavior therapy or some kind of emotion regulation techniques. And for most of my patients who have complex PTSD, there's always been a chunk of time that we dedicate to discovery of self, because if we've been repeatedly traumatized in childhood specifically, we often didn't get the opportunity to figure out who we are and what we like and don't like and what we were interested in maybe and not. And so we need to spend some time figuring that out. And so there's that component as well. But when it comes to the trauma treatment itself, it's going to be very similar, meaning we will talk through what happened to us in as much detail as possible. We might try EMDR. There can be some somatic release that we get. Maybe we do some somatic experiencing or, you know, like the EMDR, the eye movement desensitization and reprocessing could be an opportunity for us to, you know, move through that. But the most effective treatment for trauma, regardless of whether it's complex or, you know, regular PTSD, is going to be exposure therapy. I know it's uncomfortable. Nobody said that this is going to be easy, but we find, and that's kind of why the processing, like talking it through, going back to that place, talking in detail about what happened to us, even though it feels terrible and we're not going to want to do it, that's how we get out of it. That's how we make our world get bigger instead of smaller. We expose ourselves to things that we think we need to avoid because they remind us of the trauma, and we prove to our brain that it's not actually as terrifying or upsetting as we thought it was going to be, that it's okay, that yes, that was harmful in that one experience or those multiple experiences. However, it's not harmful anymore. And so a lot of the treatment's going to be the same, but I hope that kind of helps you differentiate between them. And is it easier to recover from one than the other? No. I think it just depends on the person. It depends on your resources and your own resilience and how ready and able we are to engage in the treatment. Because, I mean, everybody's experience is going to be different. And I don't want you to think that if yours is taking longer and you have PTSD, not complex PTSD, that you're judging yourself, because everybody's experience is different. Now, the final question on here, when the person asked, why does a fatal car accident in the present bring up old traumas from years past? It's because our brain, for whatever reason, and I'm going to do kind of probably a shoddy job of explaining this, but our brain likes to clump things that are similar together. And so even though it's maybe processed through or we've kind of dealt with it a little bit, it puts trauma in a certain part of our brain. That's why I love the film Inside Out. I know that's memory based, but you know, all those things are filed, all the memories are filed in the back. It's similar. And try to think of that when I talk about this, that like we've had a trauma. And so we have that marble. If you haven't seen Inside Out, all the memories are formed into marbles and rolled away into long-term memory. Now, if we have that memory, that trauma memory, okay, it rolls into our long-term memory. And then we have another trauma happen. Then our brain is like, oh, I need to file it with that one. It feels very similar to that one. It's going to trigger that old memory, that old experience, because they're connected emotionally. Our emotional memory is fascinating. It's like the same reason that when my grandma passed away recently, it made me feel even more intense grief for the fact that I'd lost my papa and my dad and my aunt and uncle, you know, in the past year. I mean, my dad had passed away like 15 years ago, but all of that was kind of churned back up in me because they're similar, because they share a lot of feelings, a lot of, you know, bodily sensations. And so when you have a newer trauma happen, it is incredibly common for that to trigger the memories or even pull out a repressed memory from our past of a trauma we experienced. And I believe it's because of that emotional memory, that body memory being very similar, and the fact that our brain connects them because they are similar, but we are reminded. Okay. I'm obviously, like I said, there if I was a neuroscientist, I could really get into the nitty gritty, but that's what I understand from what I've read and people I've interviewed, and I hope that that helps. Let's move on to question.
It's hard not to add a side of hot, crispy hash browns to your favorite McDonald's breakfast. It's even harder not to eat said hash browns before you get home. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
Sergeant and Mr. Smith, you're gonna love this house.
Bunk beds in a closet?
There's no field manual for finding the right home. But when you do, USAA Homeowners Insurance can help protect it the right way. Restrictions apply.
Number two. This question says, Katie, why at the end of every session does my therapist ask me if I want to go ahead and schedule the next appointment or reach out for one later? I know I'm reading too much into this, but the thought of her thinking that I don't really need therapy popped into my head. Of course it did. There are many things that I want to work through, but I'm slow to really open up and get into deep things. Is this just standard practice? Thank you for creating this space for us to feel heard. I love this question. Now, I used to do this, okay? Short story time. When I was first starting out as a therapist, I mean, I'd finished my hours and I had gotten my license, but I was working in my private practice in Santa Monica. And I used to do this. And a colleague of mine, Dr. Serrani, who I love, which is worked just down the street, I was telling him, because we would talk about, I don't even know, just being a mental health, you know, professional, because he's a psychiatrist. Anyway, I was telling him, you know, I like to leave it open for people so that if they don't want to schedule, I don't want them to feel like I'm assuming it. I don't want them to feel pressure if they can't, you know, can't make it. Schedules get complicated. I give them an opportunity to schedule every session. He was like, why would you do? He pointed out this concern. He said, Katie, don't do that to your patients. They're going to think that maybe they don't need to come again, or that you're like thinking that they're better than they are, or that their treatment's not important. He's like, consistency is very healing. And I'd encourage you to just say, see you same time next week and see how that feels for your patients. And I believed he was right. Okay. It's a judgment call on my part. I decided not to do that anymore because I didn't like the thought that it could stir this up in people. But you can see it from both sides. So many therapists will do this because of the things that I mentioned. I don't want you to feel like I'm assuming that you can come next week at the same time. It is an appointment, so I want to make sure that you want to keep it. It also costs money. I want to make sure you can afford it. And I want it to be a choice that you make to take care of yourself, right? I don't want to have to make that choice for you. It's really not my place. And so I believe your therapist is like I was at the beginning, where she's like, oh, I don't want you to feel like you have to. And like, it also, maybe you need to change the date or time around, right? Now, I wouldn't read anything into it, because as therapists, we're held to a higher standard in communication. And if there's something happening in your therapy where we're like, you know what, I think you're doing great and you don't need to come back, we have to bring that up to you. Like I just mentioned to my therapist last week, I was like, you know, I thought about stopping therapy for a little while and seeing how I do. And she was like, okay, we'll talk about that next time. Like, we have to communicate about it. And as therapists, it's important for us to do that. And your therapist hasn't. So there's no reason to believe there's anything going on. That's the great thing about therapy, is that therapists will communicate when something's happening, or we're supposed to. We're still human. People make mistakes. But I hold myself to a higher standard that way, where I will tell a patient, you know, Even if it's a difficult conversation, like I've had patients lash out and I'm like, the next session I say, that was inappropriate. I can't have you talking to me that way. That makes me feel very unsafe or uncomfortable. We're going to have a conversation about it, because the whole point of therapy is having a safe space to practice healthy communication, healthy relationships. And so your therapist will tell you if something's going on. If you're concerned though, and this is really getting in your head, you should bring it up again, because therapy is a great place to practice that healthy communication. And there's nothing wrong with just saying, hey, every time you ask, I always think, oh, you know, am I like, maybe I'm doing better than I think, or maybe I don't need therapy. Let them know that it's stirred this up in you, because they might be like me and not have thought about it that way. But I personally wouldn't read into it at all. I think it's just the way that they manage their practice. Okay.
At IKEA, your dream home is a blue bag away. No matter the size of your space or budget, we've got everything you need to turn your dreams into reality. And now with new lower prices on hundreds of our most popular products, bringing the dream home is even easier. Like the gray Strandom wing chair, was $369, now $299. and the IKEA Plus 365 9-piece cookware set was $129.99, now $89.99. And hundreds more. Shop new lower prices at ikea-usa.com today.
Hear that? It's the sound of someone whacking the ground with a rake. Specifically, they're beating around the bush, which we've done enough of in this ad too, so let's get right to it. The new Moneymaker scratch-off from the Ohio Lottery doesn't beat around the bush. Moneymaker. Play the game and you could win money. Up to $2 million. With more than $88 million in prizes, ranging from $50 to $500, Moneymaker cuts right to the cash. Lottery players are subject to Ohio laws and commission regulations. Play responsibly.
Let's move on to question number three. And this question says, please talk about ruminating. It's brutal, but it's helped me remember and process narcissistic abuse and bolstered me in my NC decision, no contact decision. But I need to move on too. Thank you, Katie. Of course, happy to talk about it. Now, the important thing about ruminating is to understand what the word means and why we do it, okay? So ruminating itself is when we essentially think about something over and over and over and over. We cannot stop, like, quote unquote, processing something, meaning we're actually not processing something. I believe ruminating is almost always anxiety driven, but we will think about something over and over and over and over and over and over and over again, and it's like we cannot stop, okay? That's what rumination is. It's not just thinking something through. That would be thinking something through. Ruminating is when we just do not stop. And I believe it's anxiety driven. And the reason that we do it is partially because of the fact that our nervous system is wired to seek out threat in our environment. And threat we often think of only as physical, but emotional threats are big also. And so any physical or emotional threat, we're looking out, assessing all the time. And when we find something that could be a threat to us or that we perceive to be a threat, we can focus on it so that we hopefully can understand it on a deep level and make it so that it's no longer threatening to us. But as we all know, a lot of things in our life, we don't have control over, right? I can't control how people talk to me. I can't control how quickly people get back to me or what's going on in other parts of the world and decisions other people make, right? We can't control any of that. But we can still focus on it. Our brain will want to because it feels like a potential threat. So we hyper-focus. We think about it in all these different ways, in this way and that way. Maybe that. Maybe if I did this, then that. And that feeds into the rumination, I believe. And there are probably other facets and other kind of things that are pushing this forward and making this continue. But anxiety as well as, you know, our stress response and us being wired to consider threat in our environment. So what do we do about it? Now, when it comes to rumination, because I believe it's anxiety driven, we can hit our anxiety first, meaning we could look into medications to help us better manage it. We can find ways to thought stop. For those of you who don't know, we used to think in research that thought stopping would be effective for us to, in our head, you know, close our eyes and say, stop, 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 that would stop that thought cycle. Turns out, no. Also, it doesn't help for us to, you know, try to ignore it and distract. This is one of the places where distraction does not make it better. If we have rumination, if we have racing thoughts, if we have intrusive thoughts, the best way to stop them is actually to acknowledge them, to, when that thought comes up, to say, I see you. Okay. I see you thought about, I don't know, embarrassing moment from my teenage years. And you're just a thought. I don't have to engage with you. And we let it move on. You can imagine it on a cloud floating by or on a leaf in the river, you know, as it floats by. We can think about it in any kind of way like that, but acknowledging it, calling it a thought and saying, you know what? I don't need to engage with it. We find that to be the most effective. I know. Who knew? Researchers knew. We just were behind on our reading about it and then publishing it. So it took us a while. But that's how we actually get out of rumination. And I believe that a combination of that, if our anxiety is really high, then maybe an anxiety medication could be of help too. You can reach out to your psychiatrist or a medical doctor in your area, ask them about that. But acknowledging that it's happening and choosing to not engage with it. I see it. It's a thought. I don't want to think about that anymore. And I think personally that if we acknowledge it and then distract, that would be effective. I know they were saying like distraction's not the best. I think it's when we distract without even acknowledging it that it's not the best. And so if you find it hard to just say, oh, that's a thought, and then move on, which I understand, let's try distracting after the fact. But I want you to acknowledge it. I want you to call it out for what it is. And I want you to choose to not engage with it, to do something else. And that's where distractions can come in. Like, oh, I'm going to play this video game. I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to call a friend. I'm going to play with my dog or cat or whatever. You know, something like that could be helpful too. Okay? Okay, let's move on to question number 4. This question says, why is it that self-harmers across the board all seem to struggle with validation of their emotional pain and self-harm? It's as if we're in an unspoken competition to prove who has the worst pain. I see this in myself and in my OCD. Oh, and my OCD accentuates it. Yes. So there can be an element of compulsion to my self-harm. Many of my patients feel that way. The bar keeps moving higher as to what I have to do to myself to prove my emotional pain is severe and the degree of self-harm valid, even though my head knows I'm completely valid in both. How do I begin to address the root issues and bottomless need for validation? Thank you so much for speaking about self-harm, Katie. Of course. And somebody else added on, and I'm going to say this because I'm going to answer this all together pretty much. It says, how might our attachment style influence the reasons for why we self-harm? I experience it as a compulsion, as a means of validating emotional pain. Personally, I found that drawing or writing can sometimes help. That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing. A couple of pieces here. First of all, I think most of my self-injury patients have some trauma in their past. And I know for a lot of us, trauma can feel like a heavy word. And I can't tell you the amount of pushback I've received from patients and community members over the years. They're like, I don't really think it was a trauma. Emotional neglect from our parents is abuse. Abuse is often traumatic. I'm not trying to jump to conclusions or make something out to be something that's not. I'm just being honest about what you went through. And emotional neglect or neglect of any kind leads us to believe that we are too much, that our needs not big enough, that we are not as important as other people, that us asking for basic human things is not acceptable and means that something's wrong with us. And so when we grow up in that kind of experience, and this can happen not just with neglect, this happens with physical abuse, sexual abuse, right? Our needs aren't tended to. And often when we speak up and ask for something, we are shouted down, we're ignored, or we're harmed more. So the way that we express our upset and our pain is through, I mean, I've had patients with eating disorders who abuse drugs and alcohol and also self-injure or any mix, one or many of those things. And so in your case, when you're talking about self-injury and why is it so linked to validation, it's because we never got that. And when we were a child and we were harmed, or let's say we even fell down. So I had many patients over the years who said that when they would like fall down and skin their knee, instead of a parent helping them clean it up and put a Band-Aid on it, they were like, boys don't cry or girls don't cry, you know, brush it off, get up, or what are you whining about? It's a little scratch. Like, we're minimized, we're invalidated, we're told that we're too much, and we're left to take care of it ourselves. And I've heard some heartbreaking stories from my patients over the years of being too little to have to do this, trying to bandage up their wounds or the wounds of their siblings because parents weren't there, because they didn't tend to them. They didn't care to do what they really needed to do. And so we grow up thinking that no one else is going to help us, that the validation we seek is too much. And so we try to express it this way. And that's why it feels like more and more and more. We have to keep doing more and more and more because, to be honest, it never feels like enough. Now, what do we do to get out of this? Inner child work. And that's why I brought up that attachment style, how that influences it. Because if we have any attachment issues, that means that our parents didn't show up for us in the way that we needed. They weren't either loving and consistent, or they didn't acknowledge the things that we needed and offer those to us. They were neglectful in some way. And when we don't get what we need from our parents, especially in the first like 5 years of our life, we can develop attachment issues, thinking that, you know, it's not safe. We can't count on anybody else. We can have a lot of toxic independence. I do everything myself. Can't count on anybody to show up for me. That can be because our parents didn't show up for us. Or we can find ourselves really anxiously attached And that could be because we didn't get the emotional support that we needed from one or both parents. And so we glom on to people. We become super attached to people quickly. This can happen in romantic relationships and friendships as we grow up. We try to fill that void that was left by the parent that wasn't there with somebody else. And this can happen in therapy too. We can try to put our therapist in that void. And that's really where, I mean, I have an attachment and inner child workshop on my website at katiemorton.com, but I really would encourage you to tell your therapist, hey, I think I need to do some inner child work. I need to figure out where this is coming from. It could help for you to have photos or videos of you at a younger age to reflect on, because we often forget how little we were, what resources we had available. We look back with adult eyes on child us and we're like, it wasn't that bad. But child us is like, yeah, it was really bad. And we forget. And so I really encourage you to start on that path. Start remembering what it was like to be little you, what you really needed. That's why impulse logs can be beautiful. I have them in my, it's in my book, Traumatized. Also, you can go to selfinjury.org/impulse log and find it there. But impulse logs are great. It helps us try to figure out the impulse would be to self-injure. And then the impulse log is going to ask us, like, what time and day did this happen? So we know if it's always, if we try to see patterns, is it always happening on Fridays or always at night, right? Then what is it that we're feeling? What emotions are we trying to express through our self-injury? And what could we offer to ourselves instead? And that's kind of that inner child work. Like, what is it that our inner child needs? When we do this work with ourselves, it's like we have to take a minute to consider what we didn't get back then, and can adult us offer it to us now? Like, can we show up for ourselves consistently? Can we get us support through therapy? Because what we really needed as a kid was a therapist or some support or consistency, right? And so those are all kind of pieces of it. And I know I'm talking it through quickly, but that's why I have a whole workshop on it. You can talk to your therapist and get some support there. There's also amazing books to get you started. If you go to my Amazon shop, it's amazon.com/shop/Katie Morton. My inner child books are there. You'll see them. There's a lot of children's books. That's why. Sometimes those children's books can be incredibly healing. And there's also a couple books specific to working as an adult on our inner child. So you can find them there. Okay. So that's really why. I hope that helps kind of explain it. Yeah. Let me know if you have follow-ups. Let's move on.
Two guys drove to work. Neither guy wore a seatbelt. One guy got a ticket. One guy didn't. The same two guys drove home. One guy wore a seatbelt. One guy didn't. One guy made it home. The guy not wearing his seatbelt didn't. Don't risk it. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Question number 5. This question is, hey, Katie, I was wondering why you don't see patients anymore. I know you're busy, but you have such great advice. Oh, and then there's another question. Thank you. I don't see patients for many reasons. Number one is that I used to, pre-COVID, I started whittling down my private practice around, I want to say 2018, if my memory serves me. Time's an illusion now. But I started paring it down. I used to be in the office. I was in my office 3 days a week, then 2 days a week, then 1 day a week. And it, because I traveled a lot, if you guys don't know, one of my favorite things to do is speak. And I also go to different conferences. I also teach, I lecture, I offer CEUs. And that's one of my favorite things to do. And obviously COVID kind of put a halt on that, but I had already let go of my practice at that point because I think I stopped seeing patients in like mid to late 2019. So because of all the travel and because I see a lot of BPD patients and eating disorder patients, I didn't really feel like it was ethical for me to keep seeing people, because I couldn't be consistent in a way that I think is important in therapy. And so the patients that I saw up until my last few patients were just higher functioning. So I could go a couple of weeks without seeing them and everything was okay. But even then it started to feel a little bit, again, just unethical. Like I wasn't able to put in the research time that I usually do with my patients. It started to not feel like it was a good choice, and they deserved better. And so that's really why I don't see patients anymore. And then also I find being online sometimes, although I haven't experienced this yet, but it was a concern of mine and something I talked with one of my supervisors about back in the day, is that being online, people can think, oh, she has all the answers and she can fix me. And that's not how therapy works. It's like, you have to fix you. I can ask questions and I can try to move you in the right direction. But I always wanted to be hyper aware of the fact that I don't want people to think I'm like an oracle, or that because I'm online, I know more than other therapists. There are wonderful therapists out there. And so anyway, not that, that's not why I stopped, but really the reason I stopped is just time and travel. So that kind of made it difficult. Doesn't mean I won't in the future. I keep my license active, and I also have my license now in Texas, but I just haven't opened up a office. The other question says, also, I've been wondering why boundaries are hard for me. Let's get into this. I broke my boundaries with my therapist, and it seems to be hard not to do it again. Boundaries with your therapist. I'd like to know what that was. I think I have an anxious attachment to her, and I don't know how to stop thinking of her. My mom is going out of town or the country, and I'm anxious about not seeing her for 8 days. I really hope you can shine light on why I have anxious attachment to my therapist and why it's so hard to keep boundaries with her and everyone in my family and life. You are a great help, and I love what you do. Oh, of course. Glad to. Quite a few things going on here. First of all, the anxious attachment, like I was just kind of talking about, is often an indicator that we did not get the emotional support that we needed from one or both parents. This could also be part of our anxiety disorder. It just depends on what's going on with us. Everybody's different, right? I don't want to jump to any conclusions and assume that it's only childhood stuff and that there's not also a piece of anxiety now. But anxious attachment often comes out of being emotionally neglected, having an inconsistent parent, having a parent who was there, it looks good on paper, but they weren't able to meet us where we're at emotionally, right? Like, oh, we went to a good school and they always fed us and we had clothes on our back and we did our homework and they took us to school and blah, 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 blah. But we didn't feel supported. You know, when we cried, we were ignored. You know, I don't know what happened, but those are just some of the ideas of the reasons that this could happen to you. And you need to let your therapist know that this is going on, that you have an anxious attachment if they don't already know, because I really would encourage you to do some inner child work or potentially attachment-based work, which there's some overlap there. Again, I have those two workshops available on my website, but it's also something you can do with your therapist. I would let them know, because I think that the anxious attachment is what is making those boundaries difficult. Like, one is leading to the other. I also have a boundaries workshop on my website. So if you want to go around the world, you totally can. I would encourage you probably to start with inner child, then go to attachment, and then go to boundaries, because we're kind of like laying the foundation so that we can move forward. But when we are anxiously attached, boundaries feel, they can feel devastating to us. They can feel very dangerous. They can feel like they're cutting us off from the one thing that we need, which is more support and care. And so that, I believe, is what is feeding into this. And so if we can focus on that attachment, I believe the boundary stuff will fall in line later. And because if we can find a way to soothe that anxious attachment experience, the feeling of like push-pull, I need people close, oh my God, I can't let go of them, I need you around, like kind of codependency, that feeling that we really can't make decisions in our life without other people. If we can assuage that, if we can find a way to calm that, to offer things to ourselves that we didn't get when we were younger, then boundaries won't feel so wounding to us. And then I believe we'll actually be able to place and uphold boundaries that are healthy. Because I'm actually wondering even if your boundaries are healthy. When we're struggling with anxious attachment, it can be really difficult for us to know where to place them and how to place them and how do we communicate about them. And so let's start with that anxious attachment piece, and then we can move into the boundaries, okay? Okay, hang in there. And we're going to talk about boundaries, because here is our final question. Question.
This episode is brought to you by Bye. It's Wonder Water. What makes Bye so great? It's simple. From raspberry lemon lime by Sydney Sweeney to Zambia Bing cherry and Palavo pineapple mango, Bai has antioxidants, electrolytes, and no artificial sweeteners. So for flavorful hydration, choose Bai. It's Wonder Water. Learn more about Bai and discover all of the exotic, bold flavors at drinkbai.com.
Number six, it says, why does upholding my boundaries feel so defeating? To give insight, I'm in a toxic relationship where my partner is regularly passive aggressive, and my boundary is, I cannot tolerate this behavior. I get really panicky and actually don't hear what you're saying. So whenever you do X, I will leave the conversation and go to my room. I'm saving up to eventually leave because he doesn't see a fault in his behavior and is getting really, it's getting really exhausting, I can imagine. Anyways, whenever I actually do leave, I feel like I failed so badly. Interesting. I know that boundaries are set to protect myself and to make the relationship healthier because there's no point to continue the conversation when I'm in panic mode and he gets more and more aggravated by my quote unquote not listening. It's not that I think I'm bad for having boundaries. I actually quite like having them. It's just that I feel defeated, not protected as I should. Why is that? This is a great question. And my automatic thought and belief when I read this question was, I think it's because they're not the right boundaries. Something about your boundary is not what you want. And I mean that in that, like, you leaving the I think it's great what you're doing. I don't see any fault with your boundary, by the way. I don't want you to think that me saying it's incorrect means it's wrong. I mean, it's not right for you. It's not giving you that, like you said, you don't feel protected as you should. And I'm curious if this is a current story or if it's an old story, meaning this protection that you're seeking, do we think that's coming from like a past experience, maybe childhood, maybe another relationship, or do we think it's actually current? And I'm just asking that because if it's not current, then that's why it's happening and it has nothing to do with the boundary. Everything's fine. This is just an old story that we're going to have to process through. But if you're like, no, I think this is current. I think I don't feel as protected as I should because, and I'd want you to be a little curious about that. Does it mean that you leaving that conversation or walking away still leaves you upset and we don't have coping skills at the ready to help us kind of decompress? Is it because we're stuck in this relationship? Because I also want to recognize the fact that like you have these boundaries in place and you want to leave, but you can't. And that kind of feeling of like hopelessness or a little bit of helplessness can feel icky and leave us feeling unprotected regardless of the boundary. And so we really have a little deep diving to do, but let's talk more broadly about boundaries. Now, what you're doing is great. This is exactly what I would recommend that you do, that if someone's being passive aggressive, if they're starting to get escalated in the way that they talk to you, and it's just exhausting. And the dynamic, it sounds like the dynamic and the communication between you two is just not healthy. So you're like, I don't need to keep having these conversations. I'm going to remove myself. Time out. I'm going to remove myself. You know, I don't hear what you're saying. I'm too panicked. I'm too overwhelmed. I have to remove. That's great. Now, I don't know if you return to the conversation later, just throwing that out there because that just popped into my head, because that might be part of it is like it never gets resolved. It might feel like it escalates and escalates and escalates. I don't know. But anyways, back to boundaries. Know that boundaries are something that we put in place to protect us and the person we're in the relationship with. Boundaries are not requests. Like, this person did a great job. Boundaries aren't like, hey, can you stop doing this to me? That means that we're putting all the power into for them. Like, you need to stop this. And if they don't, what? Right? And that's where the boundary is if they don't stop doing this, what are you going to do? Because you can only control yourself. Sure, we can put in a request. Hey, please stop talking to me that way. Then the boundary is that if you keep doing it, then I'm going to leave the conversation like this person did. So just as a reminder, boundaries are not requests. They're things that we're going to do. So when we place boundaries and they can feel kind of defeating or they can feel uncomfortable or icky, it often, and not necessarily in this case, like I said, you're gonna have to do a little deeper dive into where this is coming from, but for many of us, it can feel like we're gonna hurt the other person, or it can even feel like it wounds us. And I always believe that that comes out of potentially a past trauma, because if you guys don't know that one of the forms of our stress response, otherwise known as fight or flight, is fawn. And fawning is when we extremely people please in the hopes that someone won't hurt us again. So if we're going to place up a boundary, I'm not going to do this if you keep doing that, that means that we can't do that extreme people pleasing so that they don't hurt us again. And so we can feel like we're putting ourselves in a threatening position. Does that make sense? Because the fawning is what we felt like protected us. And we don't do that because boundaries are not about people pleasing. They're about, you know, safety and consideration. It can feel very threatening. So there's that piece. I also think that sometimes boundaries can feel really difficult when they were never shown in our family. If we had a really enmeshed family, or if we had addiction in our home, we can often be really codependent. So it can feel like other people's emotions are our emotions and we can't make decisions on our own. We need to check in. We don't want to upset anybody. It's like this whole, in order to keep the system going. So when we put these in place, it can feel like we're hurting other people or we're hurting ourselves. And that's really, I believe, out of the fact that these are just different. It's not something we know how to set up. It's not something we know how to uphold. It feels very foreign. And so it takes us a little bit longer to get comfortable with them. And that's why it's important for us to like practice and practice and practice and know that it's okay if we overstep our boundaries or we don't uphold them that one time. That doesn't mean all is lost. It just means that we're learning and we're trying to get better, okay? So back to this person's question. They said that they don't think that they're bad for having boundaries. They quite like having them. They just don't feel as protected. And so I guess I'd have you dig in if that's coming from an old story or a current story. And what do you mean by protected? Do we still feel like even if we leave the situation that we're still under threat, and under threat how? And is it because we can't leave that home, like we can't get out of there? Those are all things I'd encourage you to journal about and think about and see what comes up for you, because I think there's an answer in there. There was an ad on it said, as someone who's trying to recover from the fawn response, like I just mentioned, does setting boundaries ever start to feel easier? Yes, I'll talk about that. There's a small reprieve from knowing that I'm no longer fully self-abandoning, but I've been in a difficult spot on my healing journey where both my fawn response and upholding my boundaries makes me feel really dysregulated. Does it take time and practice? Yes. I know that's a shitty answer, but it's the truth. That it does get better over time, because essentially what we're having to prove to ourselves is that by placing this boundary, we're not putting ourselves in a threatening situation. And we have to prove it over and over and over again, because in our past, we fawned, right? And I love, there's actually a meme I saw online, or maybe it was a quote from a therapist, but it was beautiful and I should have saved it, but I didn't. But it, essentially what it said is extreme people pleasing or the fawn response is really self-abandonment. And that's what we should call it. And that is 100% true. And I want to say that again so you can hear it. Extreme people pleasing or the fawn response is actually self-abandonment. And that's what we should start calling it. And I couldn't agree more. And so I like that this person referenced that. So kudos to you. Doing that, setting up boundaries, it's going to feel threatening at first. And we're slowly proving to your brain that it's not, and that you are safe and okay. And so as you maybe feel dysregulated, we can do some body shakes. We can dunk our face in cold water. We can take 4 big deep breaths. Whatever helps kind of calm your system down a little bit, we can do that. And know that with time, with practice, with patience, it does get better. Okay? Thank you all so much for listening and watching. Please share this podcast. Please head over to katiemorton.com if you're looking for any of those workshops, or Patreon or YouTube memberships if you're looking for more connection to our community. Have a wonderful rest of your week. Do your homework, and I'll see you next time.